From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why you get headaches and how to get rid of them. We talk with Dr. Fred Schechtel, president of AACE, the American Council on Headache Education, and co-author of the book Conquering Headache, which has just been published in a new edition. Dr. Schechtel will share some of the latest research into the causes of migraines and tell us about the latest headache medicines. Headache Relief, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. China is defending its interrogation of the crew of the Navy surveillance plane that collided with a Chinese fighter jet on Sunday. American diplomats are trying to arrange a second meeting with the detained crew members, but China so far has declined their request. Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Sun Yuxi told reporters today that the U.S. plane had caused Sunday's collision and had violated international law. Therefore, he said it was natural for Chinese authorities to question them about the incident. Sun did not elaborate on which authorities did the questioning. Sun also said that if the U.S. adopted a cooperative attitude, China would consider granting another consular visit with the airmen. The crew of the damaged plane is being held two to a room in a military guest house on southern China's Hainan Island, and U.S. officials say they have been treated humanely. Six U.S. diplomats who have traveled to Hainan say Chinese officials have so far denied requests for a second visit with the 21 men and three women crew members, but the officials allowed them to pass on clothes and toiletries bought locally. For NPR News, this is Anthony Kuhn in Beijing.
President Bush said today that he regrets the death of the Chinese pilot in the collision, but he adds that China must act quickly and release the American crew members in their plane. Chinese officials reacted positively to the president's statement, but say it doesn't go far enough. They say the U.S. must accept blame for the crash and must offer a formal apology. A British court has sentenced a Dutch truck driver to 14 years in prison following his conviction for manslaughter in the deaths of 58 Chinese immigrants who died sealed in his truck during a channel crossing last June. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from the trial in Maidstone, England.
A jury today found Perry Walker of Rotterdam guilty of smuggling 60 Chinese nationals into Britain and of gross negligence in the deaths of 58 of them. A Chinese female interpreter, Ying Go, was also found guilty in the smuggling conspiracy. In handing down his sentence, Judge Alan Moses delivered a speech that was as much about the defendants as the broader implications of transporting human cargo. He said, "Those like you two, who traffic in illegal entrants for greed, create risk of prejudice and oppression against those seeking protection." He sentenced Walker to 8 years for conspiracy to smuggle migrants. Go got 6 years. Walker also got 6 years for each of the 58 counts of manslaughter to be served concurrently, making his total term 14 years. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Maidstone, England.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 402 points, or 4.2%, to close at 9,918 in heavy trading of 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq gained 146 points, or almost 9%, to close at 1,785. It was the third biggest percentage gain ever. This is NPR News. General Motors is recalling 6,000 sport utility vehicles and idling the plant that produces them. Eileen LeBlanc reports from member station WYSO.
A GM spokesman is asking owners of the 2002 Chevrolet Trailblazer, the 2002 GMC Envoy, and the 2002 Oldsmobile Bravada to stop driving them immediately. Problems with the suspension part have raised concerns about vehicle control. No accidents because of the parts have been reported. 30,000 of the sport utility vehicles have been produced at the General Motors plant in Moraine, near Dayton, but only 6,000 of them have been sold. The plant is expected to be idled through April the 16th. It's the second plant idling because of parts problems in 2 months. The part is on the front lower control arm of the suspension system. General Motors is asking drivers to call their dealers to pick up the vehicles and to provide alternate transportation. For NPR News, I'm Eileen LeBlanc in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
A Miami jury found today that cigarette companies are not responsible for the illness of a former flight attendant who blames secondhand smoke for her lung disease. Marie Fontana, a non-smoker, said she's dependent on portable oxygen tanks because of cigarette smoke she breathed in the days when smoking was allowed on airplanes. The 59-year-old woman is currently waiting for a lung transplant. The 6-member jury said the tobacco industry was not liable for Fontana's illness. The case was filed against Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds, Laura Lard, and Brown and Williamson. The case is the first of 3,100 claims that resulted from the industry's $349 million settlement of a national class action lawsuit. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, on the web at admworld.com.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Dial Press Division, publisher of Paradise Park by Allegra Goodman, the author of Caterskill Falls.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Headache is one of the most common medical complaints, and for people who get migraines, headaches can be disabling. But many sufferers are guided by myths about headaches and how to treat them. In the past few years, new imaging techniques have revealed more about the causes of migraines, and new medicines have helped control migraines. Here to tell us about the latest is Dr. Fred Scheftel. He's the co-director and co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut. He's national president of ACHE, the American Council for Headache Education, and chair of the World Headache Alliance. Dr. Scheftel is also the co-author of Conquering Headache, which has just been published in a new edition. Let's start with the basics. What is a migraine?
Well, frankly, a migraine is not just an ordinary headache. It's not the garden variety headache that most of us get. It really is a disabling disorder of the central nervous system, and it has a profound effect on quality of life. The majority of migraine patients suffer some degree of disability. More than half require bed rest, have restricted activity. The symptoms, according to the official criteria, are two from column A and one from column B. Column A, headache is one-sided. It's throbbing. It's moderate to severe in intensity. It can restrict or prohibit activity, and activity makes it worse. And one of the following: presence of nausea, presence of vomiting, and sensitivity to both light and sound.
We talked about migraines a few years ago on Fresh Air. What are some of the new information that we have through the new imaging techniques that have helped explain what exactly is going on to create a migraine?
Well, I think that, you know, as we have suspected and inferred from previous studies, there's no question that migraine is primarily a disorder of brain. It is a disorder of the central nervous system. Several years ago, a group in Germany using PET scan tomography put 7 patients consecutively into this apparatus during migraine attacks, and they noticed an area of activity in the brainstem, which we suspected was very much a part of what was involved with migraine, that lit up during the migraine attack. Whether or not this is the soul of migraine or the seat of migraine, I'm not sure, but it's one of the techniques that have really pointed toward the brain being primarily involved. So I think this, and together with some of the genetic studies that have been done, are clearly pointing to the brain as the seat of migraine.
This is the brain as opposed to, say, constricted blood vessels.
That's right. I think the way that we can think about migraine is that the old vascular theory of migraine that says that, well, migraine initially first starts with constriction of blood vessels, then dilation of blood vessels, I don't think it's invalid at all, because that's where most of our newer drugs work, directly on blood vessels as well as some other centers. But I think we can look at it in the following way. I think we can say that migraine represents a cascade of events that starts in the cortex of the brain, winds its way down, affects structures in the brainstem, and then ignites these nerves that are attached to these small blood vessels on the surface of the coverings of the brain, the meninges. So the changes in blood vessels, the way I'm looking at it, most of us are now, represent the final common pathway in migraine. Now, anything that we can do that can interrupt that cascade from the cortex on down finally to the blood vessels is likely to be effective as potential therapies and targets for newer migraine therapies.
Does this new information about the neurological part of a migraine lead to new theories about what triggers a migraine?
I think in some instances, yes. I think that one of the factors that we always come across in dealing clinically with patients with migraine is the need to believe they can be potentially, and I understand why, given how devastating this disorder is, that they can be potentially in control, you know, of their migraines in the sense of being able to eliminate any and all possible triggers. Now, there are some patients clearly who can clearly identify certain triggers, but there are others who don't. So I think the idea that triggers are involved is an important part of migraine therapy, but I also think and know that migraine can be triggered at times with nothing external that can be found. And though I think, for example, that diet is important, I don't want my patients to drive themselves crazy and wonder if they had a little vinegar on their salad the night before that might have triggered it the next day. The way I like to position trigger factors in migraine is to say, look, if you keep a calendar and you really do find that a given food substances or certain other things can trigger your migraine more than 50% of the time, think about it and be careful about it. But sometimes people will associate things that have no association in the attempt to believe that, okay, if I stop vinegar, if I stop this, if I stop that, leaving them nothing left to eat. I think that in terms of the question about does our newer understanding of biology help? I think it does. I think that there are certain circumstances, for example, related to environmental changes, changes in sleep patterns, changes in sleep-wake cycles that we know can interface with some of these findings we've had recently in migraine.
How does sleep affect migraine?
Well, in several ways. One, we've known that, especially in children and in some adults, that sleep seems to be a factor that turns off migraine. And I think this probably relates to what we've learned about what serotonin does. One way of looking at serotonin is it's the warm milk of the brain, so to speak. And when you go to sleep, serotonin levels increase. When patients with migraine change their cycles of sleep too much, too little, they don't do well with these changes, and it can change the tempo and pattern of migraine. So as much as possible, especially with people with frequent headache or frequent migraine, we like to try to get them on as regular schedule as possible in terms of sleep, wake, meal times is important too. Skipping meals for some patients can trigger migraine as well.
Now, you mentioned serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
A brief explanation of what serotonin is and how you think it might figure into headache. We always hear about serotonin in conjunction with depression.
Mm-hmm. Serotonin is probably one of the most important neurotransmitters or chemical messengers in the brain. It's also found ubiquitously in the body. It's been identified as being involved, for example, in irritable bowel syndrome. Serotonin has been implicated in a number of disorders. Interestingly, when we look at migraine, we find that it may be associated with other disorders, such as there is a higher incidence of depression and anxiety disorders in patients who have migraine. And from many studies that have been done, we know that it's not necessarily because migraine causes depression or causes anxiety, or as some psychiatrists believe, the reverse, that anxiety or depression causes migraine. No. They exist together likely because of this commonality of sharing some mechanisms with serotonin.
So for somebody who suffers with depression, if they're taking one of the antidepressant drugs that regulates serotonin, might that affect their headaches too if they get migraines?
It can. The information we have on the antidepressants are the following. All of the antidepressants are equally effective. That we know. The older group of antidepressants are known as the tricyclic compounds, such as amitriptyline, nortriptyline, and others. These are still the standard bearers in the treatment of migraine and tension type headache. Now, the newer drugs, the SSRIs and others like it, fluoxetine, paroxetine, and sertraline and others, though they're very
Prozac's in that category,
oh,
right?
To use brand names, yes, we're talking about Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, etc. Those agents are very effective in the treatment of depression and anxiety, and they really carry the benefit of having much lower side effect profile than the tricyclic, so they tend to be used. However, when we look at migraine, though these drugs are highly effective in treating depression and anxiety, they're less effective in treating migraine. if they're going to be effective, they take a good deal longer. You may have to wait 6 to 8 weeks before you see an effect. So generally, if we're going to use antidepressants specifically for migraine, we'll stick with the older compounds, the tricyclics, in lower dosages. However, if we do see patients that have depression and anxiety disorders that are severe enough to intervene, we will use these SSRIs and also maybe give a small amount of one of the others as well. So I do like, and most of us do prefer, these newer compounds for the treatment of depression and anxiety, because you don't get the dry mouth, you don't get the constipation that you do with higher dosages or antidepressive doses, the tricyclics.
Let's talk a little bit about the medicines for migraines. The last time we spoke, the triptan medications were really pretty new. Now there's several years of experience with it. Let's start with the basics. What is this family of migraine medicine? How does it work? What does it do?
This family of migraine medications basically are designer drugs. The prototype was sumatriptan or Emitrex, which was the first to come to market in the world in the early 1990s. What's fascinating about this is that by designer drug, I mean that we knew from many, many years and results of research that serotonin, as we were just talking about, is a major player in migraine. So what was done is Pat Humphrey and his crew in England began to work with different molecules that resembled the heart of serotonin but didn't carry the side effects of serotonin. So the triptan molecules all have this nucleus that is identical to serotonin, but different side chains which give these drugs different characteristics. The advent of Imitrex in the early 1990s was really nothing short of miraculous, mostly for patients and certainly for those of my colleagues and myself working with migraine patients, because it really provided us with the ability to be able to provide patients with medication that could abort these attacks quickly, safely, and with a minimal amount of side effects. So it fundamentally changed the quality of people's lives. As a result of the success and acceptance of Imitrex worldwide, other pharmaceutical companies have developed compounds in the triptan class. The good news is that not everybody responds to a single drug. For example, there may be people who don't respond to Imitrex or have side effects on Imitrex. So the good news is that we now have more options available for patients. However, my findings at this point, and those of my colleagues, that if you have failed three triptans, it's not likely that you're going to have great success on the next triptan coming to market. So my advice to primary care doctors is that, probably the patients right now who are waiting for the next triptan are those who have failed all three or four that are out there right now, and I would be a little bit pessimistic about their ability to respond. They simply may be non-triptan responders, but they've been marvelous drugs. People who have heart disease, stroke, certain rare forms of migraine are not candidates for this drug. But given the fact that the majority of migraine patients are without significant cardiovascular risk factors, these drugs are very safe in the right population.
There's some new over-the-counter migraine medicines, manufactured by the manufacturers of different aspirins and, Motrin and... What's the migraine ingredient in there? What makes the migraine medicines over-the-counter any different from the plain aspirins and anti-inflammatories?
They're identical. In other words, the ingredients of Excedrin migraine are the same as extra-strength Excedrin. 250 milligrams of aspirin, 250 milligrams of acetaminophen, or Tylenol, as most of your listeners will recognize it, and 65 milligrams of caffeine, and the dose is 2 tablets. The ibuprofen products, namely Advil and Motrin, each tablet contains the same 200 milligrams as the non-migraine preparations do. We've known for years that these medications can be effective in the patients who have mild to moderate episodes. The studies that were done for all three of these medications were limited to the subgroup of patients who had the most minimal disability associated with it. They did not take on all comers in their studies the way the triptan medications did. In these studies, patients who had vomiting more than 20% of the time were excluded. Patients who required bed rest more than 50% of the time were excluded. And in two of the three studies, they only looked at results up to 6 hours. So they don't know whether or not these headaches came back within 24. triptan medications all took on all comers, looked at the effects of the drug over a period of 24 hours. So I think by the time patients really report to their primary care doctors, and certainly neurologists, when they come in with a complaint of headache, to offer this stepped care approach, which means starting with the lowest-end medications, least expensive medications like OTCs, in my mind, is inappropriate, because I think that the majority of your listeners who have headache have tried, have known about these OTCs, and have tried them before complaining to their doctor, but they haven't worked. So it's ridiculous to compound it at that point by for a doctor to recommend OTC medication for patients who have already come in and failed them.
What is the point of adding migraine to the title, like Excedrin migraine versus Excedrin, if the ingredients are the same in both?
Well, because they're saying now that they have an indication through their studies for migraine, they can now say the word migraine in their ads. So if you have migraine and the following symptoms, you can try this medication.
But what you're saying is that the over-the-counter medications like Excedrin migraine or Motrin migraine, that it's the same as the regular preparation?
Exactly the same as the regular preparation. There's absolutely no difference. I was involved with the Excedrin migraine study, along with several others. But the answer is, yes, it's the same medication. Now, I don't believe that any of these three products have done anything to try and hide that fact. There are some who have claimed that. I don't think so. I think that it's interesting, though, that most patients that I have no idea that these are the same products that they have tried under different labeling in the past.
My guest is Dr. Fred Schaftel, president of AACE, the American Council on Headache Education, and co-director, co-founder of the New England Center for Headache. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. On Fresh Air, we try to introduce you to new books, music, movies, and discuss the issues of the day. On days like today, we even try to help make the pain go away. Isn't that worth the price of a pledge? I hope you'll call now to make sure that Fresh Air continues on your station. Thank you for your support. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Fred Schaftel. We're talking about migraines. He's the co-director and co-founder of the New England Center for Headache, chair of the World Headache Alliance, and president of AACE, which is the American Council for Headache Education. We've discussed what a migraine headache is. What about the basic tension headache? What's the difference between the two?
Well, tension headache, by the books, is more of an all-encompassing headache. It's usually across the forehead or on top of the head or down to the back of the neck. It's more of a squeezing, aching kind of feeling. It's not associated with nausea or vomiting. It's not associated with sensitivity to light and sound. The intensity is mild to moderate. It's the kind of headache most of us get from time to time. However, in patients who do have migraine, it was found recently that even their tension-type headaches seem to respond to triptan type of medication. In this case, it was sumatriptan. So the question is that I think that tension-type headache will turn out to be multiple disorders. I think some types in patients with migraine may be related to migraine. And like you said before, how do you know it's going to be a migraine? Again, if you have few episodes that even medicating for what appears to be a tension-type headache with a specific therapy for migraine may in fact be useful, though I'm not advocating triptans for certainly every headache that a person has. The interesting thing was in patients who had these tension-type headaches but no history of migraine, they didn't respond to triptan, so there may be different mechanisms. This type of headache may be more related to external mechanisms, the episodic variety related to issues related to muscles, But also there are studies with chronic tension type headache that show that it also may be related to changes in the way the brain processes incoming pain signals.
Yeah, you've mentioned sinus headaches. A lot of people are told that they have sinus headaches or they assume it's sinus headaches. And my impression from you is that far fewer people really have sinus headache problems than we think, and that a lot of those, quote, sinus headaches are really migraines. How can you tell the difference?
Well, I think that, number one, if you're having regular headaches associated with your menses, they're not sinus headaches. You know, they're migraine. Acute sinusitis, which can occur, is a headache that can resemble migraine because it can involve the eye or the forehead, et cetera. But generally, with acute sinusitis, there really is a discharge from the nose as well, and usually it's purulent or pussy. It's a color discharge. It's not generally a clear discharge when you have an acute infection. And the way to treat that is simply with antibiotics. But if you're having these kinds of episodes recurrently without the discharge, et cetera, you have to think about migraine. There are some patients who present with chronic daily headache that also have been told they have chronic sinusitis, but there is a small percentage who have chronic daily headache who, when you look at an MRI or CAT scan of their sinuses or do endoscopy, we actually look at the sinuses, who may have a blockage of the sphenoid sinus, which is one of the sinuses in the face, and that can cause chronic daily headache. So something you may look for in patients who don't seem to be responding to therapy, but the overwhelming majority of these headaches are clearly migraine-related.
Statistically, women seem much more prone to migraine headaches than men. Why is that?
Well, I once had a woman in a lay audience that I was speaking to, and I mentioned that it's 3-to-1 women to men, and I asked the audience, why do you think that is? And she said, men cause them. I said, but that's not the answer. The answer seems to be, when we look at it longitudinally, is number one, during pre-puberty, boys have migraine more frequently than girls. As soon as puberty comes about, the incidence goes up to almost 2 or 3-to-1 women over men. That, together with the association of migraine with menses, changes in oral contraceptives, disappearance for the majority of women during pregnancy, changes around menopause, decreased prevalence after menopause, I think shows us that for the most part, it likely is related to hormonal issues and hormonal fluctuations. However, even later on in life, there still is a slightly, not as dramatic, increased prevalence of migraine of women over men after menopause. And why that is, we're not sure. But we think hormones are a major factor.
Dr. Fred Schaftel is the president of AACE, the American Council on Headache Education, and co-author of the book Conquering Headache, which has just been published in a new edition. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, alternative therapies for headache relief. We continue our conversation with Dr. Fred Schaftel, co-founder of the New England Center for Headache. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If your head hurts today, you're tuned to the right place. We're talking about the causes of migraine and how to get headache relief. My guest is Dr. Fred Cheftel, president of AACE, the American Council on Headache Education. He's also co-founder and co-director of the New England Center for Headache and chair of the World Headache Alliance. He's the co-author of Conquering Headache, which has just been published in a new edition. Now, migraine experts usually say if you get a lot of headaches, try not to treat more than two headaches a week, or else you'll get something called rebound headache. What is this fear? What is a rebound headache?
It was found a number of years ago, interestingly, initially by Dr. Lee Kudrow here in the United States, Lisa Kudrow's dad, and he was a mentor of myself and Dr. Rappaport's years ago, that if you use acute therapies for migraine, be it over-the-counter medications or prescription medications, too frequently, you can actually generate more headache and then evolve into the more serious of the headache disorders, which is chronic daily headache, which continues to be perpetuated as long as you continue to use these medications too frequently.
So what's your advice to your patients about how many headaches to treat? And what happens if you've gone over that two per week? What do you do?
My advice is that if you're using any acute medication and you see your use escalating over time, if you're needing to take it more than twice a week on a regular basis, you need to really sit down with your doctor, because chances are it's going to escalate to the point that you're taking it daily. So one, you'll need to find more effective acute medication. Two, begin to get a little more in detail about potential triggers, lifestyle changes, preventive medications that can decrease the frequency. I think I would make exceptions to that rule for women, for example, around menstrual week, when they may need to take it a little more frequently. But I think we also know now that even the newer agents, the triptans, can be overused, so one needs to be cautious about them as well.
Now, another issue for migraine users is, when do you take the medicine? Do you take it like the moment you start feeling a headache coming on, or do you wait a little bit, let the headache kind of burn a little bit, and then take the medicine? And I think, you know, for migraine users, you're never sure. For people with migraines, you're not sure at the very beginning, is this really a migraine or not? How long do you wait? So what's your recommendation to your patients about when to actually commit to taking that medicine, particularly when you know you can only treat a certain number of headaches?
That's an excellent question, and it really strikes the crux of the matter with this. The earlier you take the medication for a migraine, the faster it works, the less side effects there are, and the lower the chances of the headache coming back. For patients who medicate early, their chances of going to pain-free and not just reducing it to mild are infinitely better. That being said, the danger signals there are for those patients that do have a higher frequency of migraine, where taking it very early at the first sign, exactly as you said, could lead to rebound headache. So what we tell people is basically, since the majority of people don't have six or eight attacks a month, but a couple, they can medicate early without it being a problem. I think even for people who have more frequent headache, they should do that, for example, women should, around the menstrual cycle. That headache is not going to remain mild. So many people will say, well, let me try my aspirin, or let me try my Excedrin. But then I look at their calendar and I say, look, 80% of the time, you go on to take a triptan. Why do you waste your time initially with this medication, especially around your period? Well, I was hoping this time it wouldn't be so bad. Early is the time to use it. But the issue, Terry, is what you said in terms of being careful, particularly if you have frequent headaches.
I know some people feel that if they treat a headache early on, it's more likely to come back. Almost as if there's a certain kind of quota of headache hours that you've been assigned, and if you... you know, if you take the medicine right away, it's going to sneak right back up on you the next day.
Well, I'll tell you, that is in the face of some of our own observations and the data, which says that the early intervention paradigm really provides the opposite results. What's interesting is that all the pivotal studies, and by pivotal studies I mean when these drugs were first examined for their effectiveness, patients were instructed to wait until the headache was moderate or severe. But when you talk to most physicians who know the disorder, they don't tell the patients to wait until they're on the floor in a pool of their own vomit, so to speak, before they medicate. You medicate earlier, you're going to do better, but be careful about overuse.
Let's talk a little bit about alternative therapies. Some of the alternative therapies, I think, are designed to get at stress, you know, biofeedback, breathing and relaxation techniques. Does stress actually cause headaches? I mean, do we know that?
The way I like to look at it is, yes, stress can trigger headaches if you have the biology. Some others may have the biology for asthma or hypertension or irritable bowel, and in those cases, lifestyle, stress, type A behavior can clearly impact on our health and almost any disease model you can think of. So if you're prone to having migraine, stress can be a factor. If you tend to be type A in orientation, you know, and I say type A people are people who work at work and work at play. You see these people on a golf course, it looks like they're doing anything but relaxing. So type A modification is very important. When you're young, you get away with it. But when you start hitting your late 30s and early 40s, you really start to be paying a price for in terms of fatigue and other kinds of problems that come up. So I think that stress management is an important factor. I don't believe that the management of migraine can or ever will be strictly limited to pharmacological treatment. We're treating people. We're not treating molecules. And how those molecules and that predisposition interfaces with who you are, where you're from, what are you dealing with right now? How's your life? How's your marriage? How's your work? What's your attitude? What's your philosophy about living? All of those things are very important.
Okay, so say you've deduced that stress does trigger a headache in one of your patients. Are there therapies, not drug therapies, but relaxation technique kind of therapies that you would recommend?
Number one, exercise. I think that exercise is a key factor.
And why?
There have been studies that show that people who are exercising a minimum of 3 days a week, 40 minutes of reasonable aerobic activity, after 3 or 4 months, will see a reduction in their migraine activity. There are a number of reasons for that. I think number one, better cardiovascular fitness. Number two, weight reduction. Number three, when you do exercise, you do raise levels of endorphins, which has also been shown to play a role in migraine. Also, exercise is a very good method of getting out a lot of the stresses and strains that we have on a daily basis. You know, it may not be that there are extraordinary stressors in a migraine patient's life, but it does mean if they have the biology for it, they may be a bit more subject to the ordinary stresses and strains in daily living. So exercise is a key factor. Diet is a key factor in terms of identifying potential triggers. Alcohol is a big one in migraine. The role of chocolate recently has been debated. MSG may be a factor. So those kinds of things are also important. Proper rest is important. I think that getting a good night's sleep on a regular basis is important.
What about relaxation techniques, biofeedback, meditation?
Biofeedback, I think there are many roads that lead to Rome. I think biofeedback is the use of technology, and in the Western world, we kind of like to see what we're doing so we can be hooked up to machines that show us levels of muscle activity or temperature, and we can be trained how to change that for the better. Yoga is another road, another way to the same end. Relaxation training, like learning how to relax muscles, regulated breathing techniques. Years ago, Herb Benson wrote a book on stress management or the relaxation response, which is basically just teaches deep diaphragmatic breathing. If you watch most people breathe, they breathe with their chest. The relaxation method of this is really breathing with your diaphragm. So when you take a deep breath, you should do it slowly, breathing in to the count of four. And I often tell patients, imagine them breathing in relaxation and breathing out stress or breathing out tension. And if you put your hand on your tummy, what you should be feeling is that tummy rising slowly. And those kinds of things can be very, very helpful for patients. For example, I often tell patients when they're driving, check your hands on the steering wheel when you stop at a red light. Are they very tight? And sometimes they find the eye. I said, use that for a second just to relax those muscles. Take a couple of deep breaths till that red light changes, you know. My colleague Randy Weeks and Steve Baskin, who work with me at the Headache Center, Dr. Weeks likes to instruct his type A patients, ready for this, folks, to drive in the right lane and relax. In other words, usually type A's are in the left lane passing and doing all these kinds of things. So there are a lot of these things that I think are really key.
What do you think about acupuncture? Have your patients had any success with that?
Yes, I think that acupuncture, there have been some studies. In fact, of all the alternative therapies, probably acupuncture has been the most intensively studied, and I think that patients can get relief from acupuncture. I would tell you this, that if you're not seeing any results after 4 or 5 sessions, you may not.
My guest is Dr. Fred Schaftel, president of AACE, the American Council on Headache Education, and co-director, co-founder of the New England Center for Headache. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Fred Schaftel. He's the co-director and co-founder of the New England Center for Headache. He's chair of the World Headache Alliance and president of AACE, which is the American Council for Headache Education. And we're talking about some of the new information about migraines. I want to get back to things that trigger a headache or that people with a headache find difficult to take. Many people who have migraines are light sensitive and sound sensitive when they get their headaches, and that's why they might retreat to a dark room or turn off the stereo or just not be around people who are talking even. Is there an explanation for that sensitivity?
Oh, absolutely. The explanation is it appears that migraine patients have more of a problem with filtering external stimuli, this kind of state of hyperexcitability that we have found associated in patients with migraine. There's a very complicated neurological phenomenon called contingent negative variance or what have you, and it has to do with the ability of patients in screening out external stimuli. For example, a non-migraine patient, if that telephone is ringing, after a while, you can actually map this out neurologically. You will see that their response to that is lowered. Doesn't happen in migraine patients. They don't screen it out as well. So during a migraine attack in particular, when the brain is kind of on hyper alert and very sensitive, I had one youngster who told me that even the light from the clock radio, you know, bothered their eyes a great deal. So it really is a problem of filtering, and the experience of these low-level sounds are as if somebody is screaming in your ear to them.
Now, a lot of offices seem to be designed for migraines. You know, you've got these like bright fluorescent lights all over the place, phones ringing all over the place, people talking on the phone, and so many people are in these like work cubicles now where there is no noise separation. So you're getting everybody's noise. What advice do you have for people who have headaches and work in that kind of migraine type of situation?
Well, it's difficult. I will write a letter for my patients, if I can, to their supervisors to provide as reasonably quiet an environment as possible for them. It's not always easy to get that done. I certainly do make a plea for changing fluorescent lighting in a migrainous room to incandescent lighting. It's much more tolerable.
What about halogen lighting?
Halogen lighting, I think, if the light is reasonably low, there's less of a flicker rate with halogen lighting than there is with fluorescent lighting. And I think it's the flickering that's really bothersome to migraine patients. The same way that those people who work on computer terminals, you know, a good part of the day are subject to this. So we have them get non-glare screens and things of that sort. And some patients even have found that there are some earphones that they can get which kind of eliminate noise from the external environment, which they have found helpful. Some will even need to use darker glasses in the work environment, because many migraine patients, even in between attacks, appear to be more sensitive to light than non-migraine patients.
Some migraine sufferers get aura before migraine. What is an aura, and why do only some migraine sufferers get it?
Interesting question, and again, we've learned a good deal about this as well. The word aura, I think, is a Greek word meaning wind, and it really means warning. About 15 to 20% of people with migraine will have the onset of pretty clear-cut neurological symptoms before the onset of their migraine. They usually last less than an hour. If they last more, it's something to be concerned about. Then the attack comes on. The aura is usually visual. It's usually related to changes in the brain. We used to think it was related to constriction of blood vessels, but now there's evidence to show that it's related to changes in electrical activity in the back of the brain where the visual cortex is. And it seems that these changes can induce the kinds of things where people may see shimmering lights in the periphery of their vision. They may lose a field of vision. They may see brightly colored spots called photopsia, or they even may lose a good part of their vision in one eye. It's called a scotomata. It appears to be related to changes really in electrical activity, not blood vessel changes. What's interesting about this is that there are a number of patients who get the aura without the headache. There are people in the field now who believe that migraine aura and migraine without aura may be separate diseases and disorders. When you look at the prevalence of both, certainly migraine is more common than aura without migraine, but it may appear that we have two separate disorders here that kind of occur together by chance. So even that's being looked at differently than it had been before.
I'm wondering if you're ever in awe of migraine. I mean, it's a problem that can be so all-encompassing for somebody who gets it because it affects vision, hearing, head pain, of course. Some people even throw up. They can't continue with life. You know, they have to, like, retreat to their room and just isolate themselves from everything for either a few hours, but some migraines can last a couple of days or even more than that. I mean, it's pretty phenomenal when you think about it.
Oh, it absolutely is. And again, when you see migraine in the context of the human experience and patients' lives and how it affects patients, sufferers, and how it affects their families, and how it affects career decisions. You know, in the United States, it was found that migraine has a higher prevalence in the lower socioeconomic groups or lower income strata. And there could be a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is that patients who have high-frequency migraine, even though they have the intellectual capacity to perform at higher levels of skill, they choose not to because of their fears or their inability to be able to perform consistently. I've seen women make, you know, choices about whether or not they can or will have children based on their migraine. Will I be able to be a good mother? Will I be able to be available? So I've seen, you know, really how devastating this can be, and I am in awe of it. On the other hand, realizing and seeing that the majority of these patients can be helped, and when you see them helped and the effect it has in their lives, I mean, to me, at least, it's really what being a doctor was all about when I was a kid in medical school and what I thought I wanted to see in medicine, and that was to be able to help people. And with migraine, that's provided a great vehicle for that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure always, Terry, and thank you for spending the time to do this.
Dr. Fred Schefftel is the president of AACE, the American Council on Headache Education, and co-director of the New England Center for Headache. He co-authored the book Conquering Headache, which has just been published in a new edition. This is Fresh Air. I hope that on days like today, fresh air is more effective than 2 aspirin. You can help us avoid a fresh air headache. Make a pledge that will help your station continue to carry fresh air. Thank you for your support. Chicago soul music was always overshadowed by Motown, but along with stars like Curtis Mayfield and Jerry Butler, Chicago also had its share of superb unknowns. According to rock historian Ed Ward, Barbara Acklin was one who almost made it.
Unless you're the kind of person like me who reads the small print on record labels, or you lived in Chicago in the late 60s, you've probably never heard of Barbara Acklin. But when I recently got a couple of her CDs, I realized that she deserved to be better known. She was born in 1943 or 44 in Chicago to a musical family. Her grandmother was a blues singer, her uncle was producer-arranger Monk Higgins, and both of her parents performed in church, which is where young Barbara started, too. There wasn't any problem when, as a teenager, she started appearing in talent contests, though, and her parents supported her when she went on to study classical voice, and then, with her uncle's help, sing backup for the likes of Etta James and Fontella Bass. Eventually, he got her a job as secretary to one of Chicago's top music business figures, Carl Davis, who was running Brunswick Records and who virtually invented Chicago's soul. But Davis preferred that she stay at the typewriter when her dream was to write songs and make records. One day, in 1966, she gave Whispers Getting Louder, a song she'd co-written with a friend, to Jackie Wilson, a Brunswick artist, and after it became his first top 10 record in 3 years, he asked her how he could pay her back. 2 weeks later, Carl Davis gave in, and she was in the studio. Only a local hit, but it got her name out to the right places. She recorded a couple of duets with Gene Chandler and attracted Eugene Record, leader of the Chilites, who became her writing, and for a while, romantic, partner. It took them 2 years to do it, but they finally charted a song they'd written together. Love Makes a Woman was not only a soul smash, but a top 20 pop hit, too. A follow-up, Just Ain't No Love, also did well, and it seemed she was on her way. Her next record seemed like it would do better, and it did, but without her. Although the song was a good one, someone at Brunswick decided that the record was better off without her vocal, and, credited to Young Holt Unlimited and retitled Soulful Strut, the song Am I the Same Girl became a smash hit. The vocal version, released the next spring, sounded like a retread and didn't do so well. She and Eugene Record kept writing, though, and occasionally hit the charts. Good as it was, Lady, Lady, Lady peaked at 44 on the soul charts. Ironically, it was the group backing her on the record, the Chi-Lites, who wound up supporting her over the next few years after she broke up with Record, but contributed lyrics to Chi-Lites hits like Have You Seen Her?, Stoned Out of My Mind, and Toby. In 1975, having not had a hit as a performer or writer for a couple of years, Barbara Acklin was dropped by Brunswick Records. After that, she more or less disappeared, making a few records from time to time and living off of her royalties. Late in 1998, she was visiting a friend in Omaha and came down with pneumonia. She died in the hospital there, almost forgotten.
Writer Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Bob Newhart. There's a new anthology of his classic comedy routines. Newhart was honored at this year's Aspen Comedy Festival. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.